America's first couple of do-it-yourself building projects.
Our books are sort of like what we are. We try and pick projects that we've had or problems and solve those problems with a design and wrote how to do that.
For instance, when we had our daughter, we had to build a lot of things that kids need, like a double-decker bed and a slide and a desk. And once we'd get enough of these things built, David would design them and build them, and we'd say, yeah, there's enough stuff here to do a book.
That's David and Jean Stiles, author of 15 books on building useful and beautiful structures with simple tools. Then we replay our 2013 interview with Howard Mansfield about his book, Dwelling in Possibility. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. The weather is warming up, and with it, folks start thinking about their backyards. Along with garden plans, you might allow yourself to dream of spaces you can build to enjoy the outdoors. How about a treehouse or a tea house? Maybe a garden arbor or just a deck with built-in seats and planters. Not an experienced builder? No matter. With a few hand tools and the latest book from my guests, David and Jean Stiles, you can make your dreams happen more easily than you think. The book is Backyard Building: Treehouses, Sheds, Arbors, Gates, and Other Garden Projects. Its simple designs are both beautiful and functional, and the instructions are easy to follow. David is the builder and designer, Jean is the writer. The two have been at it for a couple of decades at least, with books on building kids' furniture, treehouses, cabins, sheds, and my personal favorite, Woodworking Simplified. I met the couple through an ad tacked up on the wall of the Springs General Store in East Hampton, New York. It showed a beautiful, Tudor-style, handmade cabin being advertised for about the price you'd pay for a slapped-together chipboard shed from Home Depot. When I went over to the Stiles' home to see the cabin, they live near me, it was love at first sight. The cabin was a demonstration model for one of the projects in another one of their books, Sheds, the Do-It-Yourself Guide for Backyard Builders. The cabin's only 8.5 by 11 feet, perfect for a writing studio. We spoke, and in short order, I invited the Stiles to come in for an interview. David and Jeannie Stiles, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, very nice. Thank you.
Now, you have been called America's first couple of do-it-yourself building projects. I love that. It seems to me that your books are very family-oriented, oriented towards people doing things for their families with their kids.
That's exactly right. Our books are sort of like what we are, and we try and pick projects that we've had or problems and solve those problems with a design and wrote how to do that.
Yeah, exactly. That's a lot of our books have been written because we've, for instance, when we had our daughter, we had to build a lot of things that kids need, like a double-decker bed and a slide and a desk. And once we'd get enough of these things built, David would design them and build them, and we'd say, yeah, there's enough stuff here to do a book. And that's how the book would start.
So, David, you are a graduate of the Academy of Fine Arts in Florence, Italy, and then you went to the Pratt Institute, where you studied industrial design. How did these two approaches, fine arts and industrial design, come together for you in your work and your philosophy?
Well, actually, it was the opposite. I graduated from Pratt Institute in industrial design and then went to the fine arts and Accademia di Belle Arti in Florence. And I took sculpture there and found out that I was not very good at being a sculptor. So it was still very helpful because I got to tour around Europe on a motor scooter and seeing things in a different way in which you see things in the United States, and difference in the way they lived and what was important to them. And that stuck with me for the rest of my life.
Could you say more about that? What were some of the things that you saw there in Europe that stuck with you?
Basically, architecture and the rural and the survivability, is that a correct word, of their structures, their architecture. There's some of the buildings were, you know, 1,000 years old, even more than that, and they stood up well. And I always thought, gee, if only I could build something that would last 100 years, I'd be happy.
And you are teaching people how to build things that last 100 years, people who have absolutely no experience as builders. I find that remarkable. Talk about how you approach this whole way of working with people who are just do-it-yourselfers.
Well, I try and assume that they know very little, or in fact have very few tools. And I try and restrict it to mainly hand tools. I don't anticipate people having a table saw, for instance, although many do, especially with the Home Depot and Lowe's now selling to homeowners all these different machinery, which is just wonderful. But I just think of myself being somebody with a few basic tools, and what could I do at home, even in an apartment, to build something that would help me in the rest of my life, or my spouse or my family for the rest of my life. So that's about it.
They're very detailed. I mean, you really go into, you assume nothing. You go into tools, techniques, the most basic things in teaching people. I downloaded one of your simple designs for a garden shed today, and I was looking over it and seeing, you know, it's kind of like following a recipe. I mean, it is so clear. Jeannie, you're the one who does some of the writing. Could you talk about how you imagine the writing to make it so clear?
Well, that is an important aspect of our book, and all of our books, and I think it's one that makes us different from most do-it-yourself authors. Our goal is to appeal to right and left side brain people, so that when we're writing a book, and this causes a lot of discussions, believe me, we want someone to be able to look, to be able to follow the instructions just by looking at the illustrations or just by reading the text. So theoretically, they could look at David's incredible illustrations and not read a thing, and they could pretty much get the picture of how to do it. But if they don't have that type of brain, they could read the text, which is also very detailed and written so that somebody who has never really built anything could understand it, even if they don't build it. So that's our goal, to appeal to everybody.
Yeah, that's true. For instance, we've had to put together things that we bought from IKEA, as everybody else has, or from different furniture manufacturers, especially for our baby. And some of those directions are just so terrible. And one of the things they miss is that they don't show you the finished item. It's always do this, and if you do that in the right sequence, then you will end up successfully. We try and show them at the beginning what it's going to look like, and therefore they can get an idea of if they're making a mistake during the sequence, they'll be able to spot that.
So talk about some of the different projects. I mean, your most recent book is Backyard Building: Tree Houses, Sheds, Arbors, Gates, and Other Garden Projects. You're bringing together a lot of different kind of work. How do you put a book of so many different kinds of projects together?
Well, they all have in common that we're trying to get people outside, away from just a computer screen. You know, no myopia, just give them more of a vision of everything that's around them in the distance, and to be able to imagine themselves in there, whether it's a large backyard or a small backyard, imagine what's going to make them happy out there. If they have kids, maybe it's a treehouse. If they're a writer, maybe it's a writer's cottage. If they're doing yoga or tai chi, maybe it's just a small place that they can visualize, they can design, or they can use our designs and adapt them and build it and feel good when they're in there. Mm-hmm. So everything in the book, you could relate that to what I just said. It's going to make them happy, and it's going to make them feel good mm-hmm. that they can do it.
In addition to that, we think that being designers, that we might give something to them that they might think of as good design. And for instance, if somebody wants to build a shed just to store stuff in, they have a choice of going to Home Depot or building something that really looks beautiful, that they can be proud of. I mean, we think it's just as important a decision for them as they would in, say, choosing the kind of car that neighbors are going to see in their driveway. Why do people just give up when it comes to the shed in the backyard? Why don't they do something that maybe looks like their house or something that people say, oh, look at that, isn't that beautiful?
Yeah, exactly. And I think in the spirit of disclosure, I could say that I met you because I saw an advertisement in a local store, a little, you know, just a little piece of paper you'd put up with a picture of a beautiful shed, a Tudor style. Well, it's called shed, but really I think of it more as a cottage, a little structure that is so gorgeous that, that was a demonstration model, and I'm buying it. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I noticed about it, aside from the fact that it's beautiful in every way, but the detail, you know, there's the door handle is really beautiful. It's just beautiful and simple. So I wonder, talk a little bit more about your approach to design.
Well, in that particular shed, again, harkens back to my tours of Europe. They would have things like that on their sheds. And also, I'm a big fan of Eric Sloan, who is he's probably the country's best authority on Americana. You know, what people built back in the 17 or 1800s, and how they would make a latch for the door with a spring made out of a piece of ash that. It just always amazed me that they used to do that back then, and in fact, I have that on my front door, and it's worked longer than I think any metal latch would have. And so that sort of has been my approach, using things in the past that still work.
And listeners can go to the Writer's Voice website and see a photograph of that latch that I'm talking about. You mentioned Eric Sloan. I remember his work from way back. In fact, he inspired me in my 20s to try. I remember I made a shaker-style bookcase, which I still have. And your drawings are also, I mean, his drawings are very beautiful, and your drawings also just exquisite. You know, simple, clear, and beautiful. Is that a style that you just had to begin with, or how did you develop that?
Well, when I went to Pratt Institute, as I said, I took industrial design, but the thing I liked most was drawing the designs. And in fact, I became an exhibit designer at the World's Fair in 1963 and did most of the drawings for our office, and then became an architectural renderer. And so then for 20 or 30 years, I can't even remember how long, I was an architectural renderer until the computers put me out of business.
And an architectural renderer is?
Oh, that's a person who illustrates architecture for the architects to show to their clients. This is what the house or the building is that they're going to design for the client, and sort of makes it easier for the client to understand what he's getting.
So now the CAD system, which is the computerized version of architecture and plans and renderings, they can do this by putting the dimensions in, but it doesn't have any of the same creative and beauty that an illustration like David's would have, and you can see such a difference. So now and then someone will hire a person to do an architectural rendering, but you know, computers have taken that over.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with David and Jeannie Stiles. They are the authors of 24 books on do-it-yourself building projects, and their latest is Backyard Building, Treehouses, Sheds, Arbors, Gates, and Other Garden Projects. Now, the Treehouse book is among your most famous, and is it the earliest book of yours?
Yeah, I believe it is. The first one? No, I think Fun Projects for Dad and the Kids was the first one, yeah.
And then the Trieste book, though, that won the Notable Children's Library Award. That was that's just a beautiful, beautiful book. And we redid it with Houghton Mifflin many years later and expanded on it and put photographs in, but it still has the same basic, incredible drawings of David's where he shows how to build a treehouse in one tree, two trees, three trees, or even using, you know, posts in the ground, no trees. So it's very simple but very perfect for someone who wants to do it on their own.
Right. And so what do treehouses evoke? I mean, why treehouses?
Well, as I like to say, at a very early age, I was a hut nut. And rather than strictly spend my time in school studying what the teachers told me to study, I would look outside at the trees and think, gosh, that would be nice with a treehouse up there. I would do huts and treehouses and draw them. And when I got out of school, that's all I thought about, making huts and building huts and treehouses and clubhouses and anything in the woods.
And did you?
Yes, I was lucky. I grew up in New Jersey, right next to the Watchung Reservation, which is many square miles of forest. And so that was my backyard. And that's what I learned, plus going to a camp up in New Hampshire, learned all about carpentry and practiced it in those woods.
How old were you when you built your first treehouse?
No one's asked me that, but I think it's probably around 9 or 10.
And did you do that with your dad?
No, fortunately, he was busy fighting World War II. But I did that on my own and made some mistakes and learned from them.
Mm-hmm. You also built a treehouse in 3 hours for the Today Show. Oh, talk about that.
Yeah, that was in the Rockefeller Center. And, of course, we had it planned very well in advance. Every joint was marked in color and measured and drilled and pre-drilled. And so it wasn't actually a treehouse, but it could have been because they don't have trees and where we're building it. So, but it looked like one from the camera angle. And it talked about the same principles that you would have for a treehouse.
And what are some of those principles?
Well, to use half-inch lag bolts and to use pressure-treated wood where you need to and Douglas fir where you don't need to, and to try and pre-plan the whole thing and make it strong and make sure everything is sanded down so kids can't get splinters, and make the platform absolutely level and things of that sort.
Mm. Yeah, I think that would be what I would say was the most important thing is, if you start out with a level platform, you can do anything from that once you get that in place, and it doesn't have to be high up. I mean, some kids are, of course, they're going to want to be way up as high as they can, but it's not necessary. I don't know if you've ever climbed up in a tree, but you don't have to go far up to feel like you're removed from everything. And you get the same different perspective of nature and of being in the middle of the tree. And so, you know, as long as people aren't bumping their heads underneath the platform, you're fine.
That puts me in mind of my favorite tree when I was a child. I lived in New Jersey also. And just down a couple of blocks, there was a tiny little Vespocket Park, and there was a tree that, not too far off the ground, branched into four trunks. And so right in the center of it was a kind of platform. It was like a natural treehouse. And I used to go there with my books and read as much as possible. So, yeah, it wasn't very high up, but it was a magical place.
Sure.
Is Calvino the Italian author who wrote about the boy who went to live in the treehouse and they couldn't take him out? He lived there forever. It's a wonderful book, Baron of the Trees.
Yeah.
Now, you have another book that you're working on. Tell us about that.
Living Small is the working title, but I think it's a good title, and it's kind of an offshoot of the, I know everybody's heard of the tiny house movement. I don't think things have to be necessarily incredibly tiny and on wheels, but I think more and more people are, should maybe downsizing a bit and realizing that they don't need to keep adding more and more and more and bigger and bigger and bigger. They can be very happy in something that's a bit smaller. So we're exploring that in the next book, and we expect to learn a lot as we write it. So it'll be out in about a year.
One of the books, because I see that there's some stuff you've already, some work you've already done on it, is a eco house. And I read that you base it on the golden ratio.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, the shed that you're getting is also based on that. Did you know that? Yeah. It's. I was designing this house, and my friend Rajab asked me, "Do you ever do anything based on the golden ratio?" And I'd heard of that. It's a proportion, actually. So I said no, and I got a book out on it, and then I read it and took the directions of how to make the perfect rectangle and laid them over the drawing I had just finished of a shed, and it turned out I was just a few inches off, so I readjusted the measurements so that they would match the golden rectangle, which, by the way, in case your audience doesn't know, it was a proportion that Euclid, yes, came up with, and it's a perfect ratio or perfect proportion rectangle, and it was used to design the Pantheon, or Parthenon, excuse me, and also was used by Leonardo da Vinci in his Last Supper, and used in many, many different ways. Salvador Dali used the same proportion, and it's used by designers all over the world.
What's so perfect about it?
Well, it just feels right for anybody. For instance, your letter, the 8.5 by 11, is almost a perfect rectangle, almost, but it gives you an idea of the size. If you look at windows, a lot of times the window glass is divided up into panes that are 8.5 by 8 by 10, something very close to that. It seems to be a ratio that's found in nature and found in stars and in different places. It's amazing, but it actually has a mathematical validity to it too. So it has something to do with pi, which goes beyond my expertise.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with David and Jeannie Stiles. They are the authors of 24 books on do-it-yourself building projects, and their latest is Backyard Building, Treehouses, Sheds, Arbors, Gates, and Other Garden Projects. So let's go back to the tiny eco house. Also, you say it's the perfect home. Why?
Well, it's the perfect size and proportion, as we mentioned, but it has a lot of different aspects to it. It can be used, if sited correctly, it can be used with solar on the roof, solar collectors, and it can have a catchment system for catching rain, which comes down and is collected in a tank below the shed that's in the ground, and then that water can be pumped up into a sink. I would suggest not using it for drinking, but it'd be good for washing dishes or doing clothes and things of that nature. And it has a composting toilet inside. It has beds for two people, and it has a writing desk and all sorts of good things.
And what are its dimensions?
That one's at 10 by 12. 10 by 12, I think, is the ideal size. It's not too big. It's not too small. Your shed, unfortunately, is not quite as that big, but it's not intended to be, you know, for two people. So I think it's going to be perfect for you.
It will be perfect for a writing retreat.
Yes.
Now, you also, David, you received a couple of awards for designing playgrounds for handicapped children. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, that's, it's a playground that was built right after the World's Fair. And it's very close to the Flushing Meadows site of the World's Fair, across the highway, I guess. It was a competition to design a playground for both able-bodied and for children who are disabled in some way to play together, so there's no distinction. So you had the ideas I saw was to give the advantage, perhaps, to the disabled child. So things would be difficult for the able body, might be easier for the disabled one. And so I did all sorts of things, like a water wheel that you could shoot a stream of water into it, and it would turn and make a big thing go around and make things work, you know, sort of. And then there was a lot of other things that a disabled kid could get up on and slide down, or to operate. For instance, a simple swing like you see in a playground had an extension above it, so that when the kid swung in it, it would move the thing above it in a big arc, and like it would give him a feeling that he's actually done something, moved something, which was something that, you know, in his life, normal life, he wouldn't be able to do.
Didn't you also have something kind of a maze? So, because one of the disabilities was, you know, blind kids, and so there was something where, yeah, they were tactile, so they actually did have the advantage, whereas people, you know, kids who could see, it didn't help them. You know, they weren't tuned in to feeling things and in that way. So it was very, very clever.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with David and Jean Stiles about their latest book, Backyard Building: Treehouses, Sheds, Arbors, Gates, and Other Garden Projects. One of the designs you have, which actually is the design of the building that I'm getting myself, it's a timber frame cottage, and it's put together. That means it's put together with mortise and tenon.
Mortise and tenon. Yes.
Yeah. Talk about that. It's an amazing joint. It seems like it would be very hard to make, but you make it look like it's simpler.
Actually, it's a lot harder to make than your average joint. Using a pneumatic gun in construction with 2x4s, it takes about less than a half a minute. I mean, this one takes a good half an hour, because you have to form two pieces of wood to match each other, to join into each other. And you have to have a hole, a trennel, which is a peg, to lock it in place for good. And it means a lot of testing and fitting and back and forth until the two pieces of wood are so close together that they don't quite fit. And then you shave off that last paper-thin shaving of wood, and it fits together. And it gives you a wonderful feeling of accomplishment. And besides that, it makes a much stronger joint than a 2x4 joining a 2x4.
So is there anything you would like to say about what you like best about doing these books?
Well, I think both David and I like to be able to inspire people using his designs, really, and writing something down and being an inspiration for others. And also, through our books, once we write them and the publishers get them out there, we're inspired by other people. And we meet an incredible amount of interesting people. The people who write back, the feedback we get, and especially with tree houses and with small houses and sheds, we'll get emails from people saying, thank you so much for, you know, this design. We love it. And they'll enumerate everything they love about it. And it just makes us feel so good. And we meet new people. We meet people all over the world. So it's really great in that way. It's a wonderful thing to do.
People are creating their own dwelling place.
Yeah.
Well, David and Jeannie Stiles, I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking with us here on Writer's Voice. You've written 24 books, the latest of which is Backyard Building: Treehouses, Sheds, Arbors, Gates, and Other Garden Projects. Thanks again.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Francesca. We enjoyed it.
David and Jean Stiles. Their latest book is Backyard Building. Go to writersvoice.net to see photos of my new writing studio built by David Stiles. I'm still looking for a name for it, so if you have any ideas, be sure to leave a comment on the website. Next up, Howard Mansfield and Searching for the Soul of Shelter. Stay tuned after the break.
song when the world was new. Water of laughter sings it true. O wizard of changes, teach me the lesson.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Back in 2013, I spoke with Howard Mansfield, a writer with a unique sensibility about architecture and place. We talked about his book, Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. Here's that interview. What makes a home a place to dwell in, a place that makes us feel happy to be alive? Why do some places invite us in, and others feel like soulless boxes? These and many other questions about dwelling are explored by my guest Howard Mansfield in his new book, Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. Its chapters explore such different branches of the question as, how does losing electrical power in a storm change us? The meaning of the destruction of homes in war, the house as a stage for reverie, and how communities are seeking to bring back homes that encourage relationships instead of consumerism. Writing about preservation, architecture, and American history, Howard Mansfield has contributed to the New York Times, American Heritage, The Washington Post, Yankee, and other publications. He's also the author of 6 books, including In the Memory House and The Bones of the Earth. I started out our conversation by asking Howard Mansfield to read a passage from Dwelling in Possibility.
I liked house hunting. I am fascinated by how houses succeed or fail to shelter us, body and soul. I could go from house to house clear across the country, knock on doors and ask, can I come in? Look around? What's your favorite room? Your latest house project? I'd like to see them all. The sour living rooms behind dirty windows and overgrown shrubs. The small rooms made smaller by dark wood paneling, big fat lazy boy recliners, and the large screen TV. McMansions where rooms and rooms leak space. Prim places where the grass is edged, the shrubs are obedient, and inside the couch is under a plastic cover, and the cabinet of curios is dusted and gleams at attention. Houses where the Bible and the baby Jesus are the only ornaments, and guns lie asleep in drawers and cabinets. Houses that are all noise, as if they are cotton candy spun from the loud, always-on TV and the radio giving traffic reports to the resident who doesn't drive. Houses that smell from the morning's bacon all day long, where one breakfast seems to compound the next. Houses that are worn and comfortable like an old fielder's mitt, like the sweatshirt and jeans a commuting executive wears on Saturdays. Houses that are mysterious in their blandness. The rooms of furniture stood out as expected, as prescribed. But you know no one really lives there. Where's the real life? This is a front. You don't want to see, and you do want to see, the private rooms. Houses that are walled with photos of children, grandchildren, nieces and grandnieces, the walls of diplomas hanging like battle ribbons. Houses that you pass 100 days, 1,000 days, maybe every day of your life, and no one enters. Even the lawn seems to be self-mowing, the mail self-removing. Houses that command a hill. Houses that play hide-and-seek behind trees and shrubs. Houses in which terrible things have happened in daylight. Houses in which nothing has happened, and that seems terrible. Houses where the boredom yellows the walls like grease from 10,000 meals. Houses that grow old with their inhabitants, roofs and walls and windows, all flaking, peeling, breaking. The house has arthritis. The house is closed to the world. Houses that spill out toys and bikes and cars and tools and projects, sometimes right to the line of their neighbor's land. Thousands, millions of houses. You drive past them at 1 a.m., 2 a.m., all those people asleep, snoring, dreaming, all in the dark, trusting in the state that no marauders will come in the night.
Yeah, that's just beautiful. And you write, in fact, that the peak of dwelling is poetry. It's a quote from the philosopher Heidegger. But I think you've just shown us the kind of poetry you mean in some ways.
Yeah, it's the poetry of the ordinary, isn't it? It's just it's everyday life. It's the nothing much that is home. It's peace, silence, and dreams. It's clutter. It's the mess on the table or the drawings on the refrigerator wall. It's tumult. It's passing the time with friends. It's the little landmarks of the house, you know, the funny thing your aunt gave you, or the ugly wedding present you can't really part with because it reminds you of somebody, different things that have just been with you forever.
So tell us, what is the soul of shelter? What do you mean when you say that dwelling is a soul of shelter?
Dwelling, which is, you know, obviously in the title of the book, Dwelling and Possibility, dwelling is an old-fashioned word, I think, that we've misplaced. And what I mean by that is when we dwell, we're really present. We're here. We live heart and soul. We are committed to that place. Essentially, we have possession of it, and it has possession of us. And so, therefore, we dwell.
And yet, we've been really getting away from dwelling. We build anti-dwellings, you say. What does it say about a culture that builds houses but not homes?
Yeah, it's a big problem, and it's one of these real divisions, is that so many ordinary things that were once just very common in the house have changed in the last 100, 150 years, so that today, I think, we're crowding ourselves out of our dwellings, out of our houses. We're crowding ourselves out with clutter, which is just a big obsession of the age, and crowding ourselves out with visual clutter, virtual clutter, I mean, so that we're not really there anymore. We kind of just check into the place, and we find it not satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the more it's not satisfying, the more things people tend to accumulate. It's almost like junk food or junk calories, in a sense. You keep trying to compensate for that. So you move to bigger and bigger spaces and fill it up and move on. Two quick examples of that. At the founding of the country, the average house size was about 700 square feet, which is the size of about a two-car garage. And it was filled with people, maybe 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 people would be living in that space. And you might have a bowl, a spoon, a table. That would be it. Today, we live in 10 to 14 times the amount of space on average. And it's filled with stuff and few people, maybe 2.3 people on average. And still, 1 in 10 families rents a storage shed. And there's more storage sheds in this country than McDonald's now. The Storage Shed Association, the inevitable trade group, says that if every American wanted to, they could shelter under the space of storage shed. So it's a complete reversal. We have things replacing life, stuff replacing life. And the virtual clutter thing is like how much that work has followed people home, and we all have these computers with all these post-it notes on and all these peripheral things. And the study I saw said that on average now, Americans are spending 8.5 hours a day looking at screens. That's television screens, smartphones, GPS, computers. 8.5 hours a day is a heck of a lot of time.
There are three parts to this wonderful book, Howard Mansfield. The book is called Dwelling in Possibility. One is dwelling in the ordinary, which we've just started talking about, dwelling in destruction, which is also a fascinating section, and dwelling in possibility. Let's go back to the ordinary again. You have a chapter early on about being caught in the ice storm of 2008. Now, that wasn't a very ordinary experience, but it really puts you in the here and now. Your electricity was out for a while. There was an inconvenience, but there was also an upside. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the storm was fierce. I mean, we woke up to the sounds of huge limbs of, you know, 100-year-old and older trees just falling on the house and near the house and crashing down and not knowing when that would stop. And the place, our part of New Hampshire, looked like a tornado had been through. Wires down, trees tipped over, transformers on the ground. And we were without power ourselves for 6 days in the end of December. And what happened once you got past the terror of everything falling onto your house was that our house, it's not that old a house. It's 1880. We have an old wood stove in part of the house. And so all of a sudden, we began living by the wood stove, the old Vermont Castings wood stove. Back there we were, the old steady Reliant stove, feeding it from the wood pile, living by the light of the fire, looking at the fire, discussing what we didn't know because there was nothing but rumors and no information around. And all of a sudden, the entire house was different. It's pre-electric self emerged. These the smell of the house and the wood smoke. The colors of the day were completely different in the house because you didn't have electricity. So as the light faded early in 4:30, 4:30, the light in the house changed. And it was just a different spirit in the house. It was kind of terrific in that way. And everybody was released from their routine, so you'd run into people all over the place. And we had wonderful dinners with our neighbors, you know, around candlelight, everybody just salvaging what they could from when everything was melting and ruining, so you might as well eat it. So it was a little bit of like a week and a half long snow day in which you couldn't get email or anything. But it released us to experience more of the present.
Yeah, and just the light, the quality of the light, the quality of the heat. You know, it used to be the hearth was almost synonymous with the home, and yet we don't have hearths anymore unless they're kind of decorative with a couple of gas logs twinkling merrily.
Exactly, and that is the huge change that kind of came home to me, kind of like an aha moment, but more of like aha duh moment for myself was that, oh my gosh, for thousands of years, we lived first outside by the campfire. We always lived by a campfire, told stories by a campfire, the whole thing. And then when we moved indoors in the Middle Ages, you always have these tales of these huge halls with these smoky fires and birds flying through and bards declaiming the news and everything. And then someone said, let's put that fire under a hood. And then someone said, well, let's make a big fireplace. And this took thousands of years to figure out, you know, how to get the smoke out. And then the fireplace became smaller and actually started generating heat. And then the fire got put into a metal box, the wood stove. And then for most of us, the fire, the hearth disappeared, went into the basement. And that hearth central house really was gone. And this was really disorienting. You've read about it in the Beecher Sisters and other people at the sort of towards the end of the 19th century. It was like a whole spirit had gone out of the house. Houses were warmer, but a spirit had gone, that sense of everybody sitting around the fire or families gathered by the fire, either having great times or getting on each other's nerves, depending on the family. But once the hearth goes out, once the fire goes out, everything is decentralized. Everybody is free with the hearth gone, with central heating, with electricity. You don't have to cuddle in one place. Everybody's free to go off to their separate rooms and their own gadgets. And it's life is decentralized. Life is not as central. And you see the same thing happening in cars today. It used to be when we were growing up, it'd be like an AM station. Everybody would listen to that or play stupid car games on long trips or annoy your brother. Now you drive past cars and these video screens are down and the kids in the back are just each watching their own video screen or everybody's plugged into their own iPod. It's the same kind of thing, you know. Classic American space, I think, is, you know, cabin in the woods. The iPod is a cabin in the woods. You're always kind of recreating that isolation.
So what do you think that means for us as a culture? I mean, we're spinning away from each other in so many ways. How do you see that happen? What are the ramifications of that you see for our society?
Well, I think everybody pretty much knows there's a lot of isolation, that sense that people aren't talking to each other, this sense that we think that the next gadget along is going to kind of recreate this for us. I mean, a survey I saw by an academic said that parents and children spend an average of 14.5 minutes a day talking. That's the total, which I guess if you had a teenager would be an epic conversation. But anyway, so, you know, we're just more and more isolated from each other in a lot of ways. And everybody can be plugged into whatever they want now, essentially their own channel. You can choose your own facts on the internet if you want. You can download your own music. You can just go your own way. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, very troubling on a lot of levels.
And yet it's touted as a heightened form of connectivity because we can connect with anybody all over the world. What does it mean when we can connect with people far away, but we can't connect with the people right here at home?
Yeah, I mean, we wrestle with that all the time. It used to be that if everybody lived in, say, the same town, everybody was more or less on the same page and knew what's going on. And now it's not true. There are people who know what's going on. There's people you talk to. But there's other people who are plugged into maybe some kind of community around the world or a community that they work in. And it's just different levels and different layers, and it's harder to find the commons. I think it can still be found. We have to sort of work to kind of create that, to find that.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Howard Mansfield about his wonderful book. It's called Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. Now, let's go on to dwellings and destruction. I know a little bit about this history because I've done a lot of work on World War II and It's one of my interests, and I don't think a lot of people really know about the firebombing, the incredible devastation of the firebombing that the Allies unleashed on Germany and Japan during World War II. But you actually start the chapter out with Vietnam, burning villages in Vietnam. So let's start there. Morley Safer broke the story. Tell us what that story was.
It might be the most famous couple of minutes of television ever aired. There in the year, and it's not like the front of my mind, was it 1965 or 66? Anyway, early in the 60s, Morley Safer just filed this report from CBS News showing American GIs going into a village, lighting huts on fire, and, you know, killing people. And this just caused huge upset in the country. People couldn't believe it. They just denied it. They said either Morley Safer had staged it or given the Zippo lighters to it. And it's still today on the internet. You can go all over and read fierce denials of it as if that one image lost the war. It was just very upsetting to people, as it rightly should be. And it's emblematic of what war is about, which is about destroying your neighbor's house, destroying your neighbor's home, driving your enemy, that person, off the earth. It's just a visceral image, and that's why I think there's such strong denial of it. And it's just a basic level of dwelling, I think.
Well, describe that image a little bit more for us. You know, what was happening? Because there were many, many instances of this. You know, what would happen when U.S. soldiers would go to a Vietnamese village and, you know, put their Zippo lighters to the roof thatch? And, you know, what was going on in the village?
See, you see people, women and children huddled together. You see them crying. You see old men there pleading. It's just a visceral confrontation.
Yeah. And that was their entire livelihood was contained in those houses.
That was their house. I mean, it's as if someone came and burned your house down. I mean, they're different kinds of houses, but it's just exactly that.
In Vietnam, like everywhere else in Asia, property, a home, is everything. A man lives with his family on ancestral land. His parents are buried nearby. Their spirit is part of his holding. If there were Viet Cong in the hamlets, they were long gone, alerted by the roar of the amphibious tractors and the heavy barrage of rocket fire laid down before the troops moved in. The women and the old men who remained will never forget that August afternoon. The day's operation burned down 150 houses, wounded three women, killed one baby, wounded one Marine, and netted these four prisoners. Four old men who could not answer questions put to them in English. Four old men who had no idea what an ID card was. Today's operation is the frustration of Vietnam in miniature. There is little doubt that American firepower can win a military victory here. But to a Vietnamese peasant whose home means a lifetime of backbreaking labor, it will take more than presidential promises to convince him that we are on his side. Morley Safer, CBS News, near the village of Cam Ne.
You say that what was on fire there was the old way. It wasn't just that we were burning down the houses of, you know, people who were incredibly poor on the other side of the world, but we were also setting fire to the old way of being.
That's the way it seems to me. There's a great quote by this historian, architectural historian named Reichert. He says, you know, paradise is a promise as well as a memory, and that we always have the hut with us, this memory of this kind of primitive hut. And I think that's one of the reasons why it resonated with people. I mean, in Vietnam, we waged this war against the earth. I mean, burning down forests, poisoning forests with ancient arch, bombing forests. We've turned away from even thinking about that anymore. There's a wonderful historian, a Romanian historian of religion, the sacred, and I'm going to mispronounce his name, Mircea Eliade.
Oh, Mircea Eliade, yes.
Thank you, Mircea Eliade, who says that a dwelling contains the world. It's sacred, and it's like a small map of the cosmos. And I think instinctively, when we look at bombed out images of Vietnam or Europe, that's what we're responding to.
Hmm. Well, in Germany, too, why did the Allies decide to firebomb the civilian populations of Germany so intensely? And of course, they weren't the ones who started. I mean, the Germans, you know, were the first ones to start that kind of massive bombing of populations. But what we unleashed in Hamburg and in Dresden, just...
Dresden towards the end of the war, and they tried to burn Berlin about 12, 14 times. This is a very, it's a complicated and naughty story. You keep, depending on how far you crank it back. If you go back to World War One, the Germans bombed a couple of English cities, Hull, and from Zeppelins. And once that happened, during the interwar years, the promoters of air power said, you know what, we have to, if we can go in and bomb the enemy next time so much, they will relent. We won't have that many soldiers come in. So air power was oversold. That didn't happen. What the British wanted to do was to bomb the Germans out of their house and then therefore stop wartime production, disorganize the economy. And they had it was a cabinet level paper. It was an official policy called de-housing. So we've always learned that, you know, you go in to bomb the ball bearing factory and you hit some houses. Well, actually, they were aiming for houses, and they developed a particular bomb. It's called the fire bomb, which weighs about, in some versions, 4.5 pounds, 6 pounds, really light. And it's designed to hit the roof, kind of land in the rafters, and start a fire. And it was developed by fire engineers and chemists in the United States and in England. And we built different doom towns, different models of Japanese and German cities, and test bombed them in the Utah desert and also, I think, in the south of England, and to see how could you start the best fires. The entire policy didn't work. Many Germans, as were bombed out of their houses, which is some phenomenal amount. German wartime production just increased steadily up until the last part of the war because there was just so much excess industrial capacity, apparently, and slave labor. And it's horrific. It's just horrific on a lot of levels. Obviously, the Allies were fighting against an enemy that was going to fight to the end. And, you know, it's very hard for a democracy. A democracy gets pulled into this and has to do things it doesn't want to do. I got into this whole thing in the book, not from the bombing end almost, but from the rubble end. I was reading three writers who I think are the most profound writers about dwelling. This fellow, Max Picard, who's a philosopher in Switzerland, no one's heard of, wrote this wonderful book called The World of Silence. And the book is like a found object. It's just an amazing description of silence. And then Gaston Bachelard, who some people know through his wonderful book, The Poetics of Space, which he says, a good house is a daydreaming space. It's a place where we can, for reverie. And he wrote that book at the same time that Picard was writing The World of Silence. And then Heidegger, the famous philosopher in Germany, wrote this essay, Dwelling, Being, Thinking, I think. And I realized, oh my God, all these three philosophers are writing exactly when Western civilization is in ruins. And all of them, I think, are trying to say, how do you make a house sacred again? How do we make it safe to dwell again? How do we do that? And each, I think, has their own answer. You know, silence, dreams, or just this Heidegger's idea about being and letting the place be and letting the place have some kind of presence at that spot. And that all, I think, comes right out of the war because they're all writing when Europe's in rumble. And that's all, I think, in part, a result of the ferocious war that was fought in Europe and Japan as well. Because you go to Europe today, it's just everything's restored and looks wonderful. It's very hard to imagine and to get our minds back to how extensive that devastation was.
Heidegger is a very interesting case because I think, as you rightly point out, in some way he prefigured today's environmental movement, and even further back than World War II, you can look at the turn of the century, there was a whole conservative or even reactionary right-wing movement that, in fact, was saying, wait a second, there's something wrong about consumerism, about mass culture. We need to get back to our roots. But it led to a very different place than the environmental movement today. And you do talk about that in the book Dwelling, Howard Mansfield.
There was a sense that, well, particularly when, to just pick up where we were, I guess, with Europe, when these cities were rebuilt, modern planners didn't like, you know, twisty little streets and small lots and all the things that today you would say is good urban design and good pattern. And so they further went in and rebuilt on a very soulless level and actually bulldozed even further. And people just, a lot of people just felt alienated and they wanted their old city back, and you can't get your old city back. But it was just a growing awareness that each place on Earth is unique unto itself, and that needs to be sought out, respected, cultivated if possible, whereas all the tendencies of the age are going the opposite direction.
Right. Then you talk about a Frank Lloyd Wright house in Connecticut, which I loved. I went online to look at it. I love Frank Lloyd Wright's architecture. Tell us a little bit about his vision, how he saw dwelling.
Okay, yeah. We're talking about the Zimmerman House, which is in Manchester, New Hampshire, and it's owned by the Currier Museum of Art in Manchester. It's a wonderful house if you're come up and visit it, or come by and visit it if you're in the area. It's been beautifully curated. It's not a very big house. It's sort of like a larger version of his Usonian house, which he said would be a house for everybody. But the house is a complete object. Everything is designed in it, you know, from the silverware to all the finishes, and it's done. And you, the furniture, you live in it. It's not like when you live in this house, you're going to be thinking one day about adding a wing or updating the furniture, or adding granite countertops. It's finished. It's surprising. It's on a corner lot in the city, yet once you walk into the house, it opens up to this backyard that it seems like it's acres and acres deep, and the outside seems to be part of the inside, and it's very liberating to me and a beautiful object. And the Zimmermans who lived there were happy there, really enjoyed the house. And the house, they weren't like slaves to some kind of Frank Lloyd Wright vision. The house freed them to live their life. I say all that defensively because there's a huge division of a feeling about people who go to visit this house. Some people love it and a lot of people hate it. They feel controlled by Frank Lloyd Wright's vision. They feel closed in. They just want to get out. Some of the rooms are small by modern standards. So strong, strong reaction. And I think that reaction is that, you know, no home improvement. Their house is finished. You know, go live your life. And I think people kind of have a reaction to that. What do you mean we can't just, you know, go get a new carpet? Or what do you mean we're never going to build a wing here? You know, what do you mean we're done? I think that's the reaction to that house.
But wouldn't you want to make a house your own?
Yeah, to the Zimmermans, it was their own.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think there is that unsettling feeling that, you know, every Frank Lloyd Wright is somehow the third person or the fourth person in the house. I do think that is the question when you're there. You know, are you free to live your house as the Zimmermans, by all accounts I've read, were, or do you feel like you're being curated by the architect? You know, you that's the question.
Well, Harold Mansfield, this has just been such a delight to talk with you. We've just skimmed the surface of your wonderful book, Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. Thanks so much for writing this great book and for talking with us here.
Well, thank you, Francisca. I really enjoyed it. It was a great pleasure.
Howard Mansfield's book is Dwelling in Possibility. Read an excerpt at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.